I'm Denise.
She's a non-fiction editor. And I'm Louise.
She's a fiction editor. And together, we're the Editing Podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Editing Podcast. Today, we're diving into a topic close to every proofreader's heart, the tools, checklists and techniques that support consistency and accuracy.
Oh, yes. So whether you're a seasoned professional or you're just starting out, having a solid toolkit really helps you work efficiently and avoid missing errors.
Exactly. So in this episode, we'll share our favourite tools, some practical techniques and simple checklists that will help you keep your proofreading consistent and reliable. And then at the end, we'll talk a little bit about the particular way we each approach our work in terms of proofreading, because we work on very different areas, don't we?
So we do.
It'd be quite interesting to hear how the way you do stuff differs from the way I do stuff.
So why don't we start with why having a toolkit is important to us as proofreaders? So proofreading is detail-heavy work, and even the most experienced proofreaders can miss things, especially if they're relying solely on memory or eyeballing.
Yeah, yeah. Having a systematic approach reduces mistakes, speeds up your process, and gives clients confidence in your work. But it also helps you maintain consistency across different projects. Style, punctuation, that's different. Formatting, stuff like that.
Yeah, exactly. So a toolkit isn't just gadgets and software. It's the combination of methods and resources and habits that you have that make your work reliable.
So should we chat about some tools, the things that make it easier?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. So we've got options that are both digital and analog.
Yeah, so on the digital side, you've got things like Microsoft Word's track changes and spell and grammar checks. And they're obvious and pretty essential, but they're just the start, really.
Yeah, they really are. They're your sort of basics that you really need to have, aren't they? But then we've also got specialist proofreading software tools like those that work as Word add-ins, stuff like Perfectit, which helps with consistency and style checks.
Yeah, and I suppose we shouldn't forget that lots of proofreaders work on PDF. So they'll be using things like Adobe's onboard markup tools.
Yeah, some editors do like to use the stamping tool to actually stamp the PDF with markup symbols, as you would if you were marking up on hard copy on paper. And you can find those on Louise's website. And I think you've got three different colours, haven't you?
Three different colours. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And Denise, actually, I want to shout out your course, because I think that's an essential for anybody wanting to learn how to mark up in PDF, particularly using the standard tools you'll find in things like Acrobat, the free version of Acrobat. And so you can find that on Denise's website, and we'll pop some links in the show notes for that too.
Yeah, we'll do that, yeah. So the other things we have are reference tools that we use regularly. So things like the Chicago Manual of Style, APA, or House Style Guides.
Yeah, and those are essential for resolving really tricky punctuation and formatting questions when you're dealing with people who've got quite specific needs.
Yeah.
Then it's just like there's a way of doing things. It's not even about the fact that one way is right or wrong. It's just that, you know, sometimes a client will want you to work to a particular style.
Yeah, they choose that, and then it makes it easier for you.
Those criteria, doesn't it?
Yeah, because then all your decisions on lots of these variable style choices are made for you, because they're in that particular style that your client selected. And the other thing we mustn't forget are things like dictionaries, thesauruses, thesauri, I think I like thesauruses. I don't know.
I like thesauruses as well. Yeah. Like hippopotamuses.
Yeah, and dinosauruses, you know. Yeah. Dictionaries, thesauri, and other online reference sources. And even experienced proofreaders consult them regularly, because we know that we don't know everything. And it never hurts to double check things.
And you sometimes just forget.
Of course you do. There are certain things that I look up regularly because I just don't hold them in my head.
Yeah.
Don't ask me what they are, because I don't hold them in my head.
And then on the analog side, you've got things like, I mean, some people really love printed checklists or physical style manuals, because that reduces screen fatigue. I mean,
absolutely.
We've all experienced that as well. You know, where you just think, oh, great, you know, I've got this dictionary online, I've got this online, I've got this style guide online, but actually I just want to hold something in my hands.
Yeah, yeah, and that's absolutely valid, but I think it's important to be aware that the advantage of your digital one is that it's kept much more up to date than a printed one. As soon as something, you know, especially if you're talking about dictionaries and thesauri, as soon as they're printed, they start going out of date, don't they?
Yeah, yeah. Online, and that means you have to fork out more money to get the most up-to-date one. So I do. I'm with you on that.
Yeah. So the thing about all of those tools is that they're all about keeping our workflow as smooth and reliable as possible.
Yeah. So what about checklists? Because I think these are a secret weapon. I mean, we love a checklist, don't we?
We so do, God. They're so simple, but incredibly effective for catching errors and just making sure that nothing slips through the cracks.
Yeah, especially when you're working with a client who's got very specific expectations.
Yes, yeah.
So a basic checklist might include spelling, grammar, punctuation, formatting, numbering, headings, cross-references, and consistency of style. But I've actually got a pretty comprehensive proofreading checklist that I can link to in the show notes too, something I created after working with publishers for years.
Yeah, I think can people get that free from your newsletter?
Yeah, they can, and my website. But yeah, some editors some editors like to create more advanced checklists that are tailored to specific client preferences or to their own. You know, that's the thing, isn't it? You work on stuff over the years and you think, oh, that's this thing that I'm using, this tool that someone else created, you know, that's nearly there. It's just, I just want that thing as well.
Yeah, and I think that's something that we can talk a bit more about when we get to our chatty bit, because I think you and I maybe do slightly different things here, but yeah, good to talk about. So as an example of that, these sort of checklists might be used for checking specific house style rules or for use with specific document types like academic theses or marketing materials.
Yeah. And the thing I think about checklists is that they help if you're tired or distracted. It's going back to that fatigue thing we were chatting about a few minutes ago. Because even when your brain is on autopilot, the checklist guides your eyes because it's physical.
Yeah, yeah. They're kind of like a safety net, aren't they? And if you work with multiple clients, having separate checklists for, you know, different clients or per project type, it really is a game changer.
Yeah, and again, that's something we can explore later, because I'm quite interested from your point of view, because we work, you tend to have like more projects going on simultaneously. Mm-hmm. So I can see why that would be perhaps more important for you than me.
Definitely.
So, but first, let's talk about proofreading techniques, because that's important too. But, you know, if we're thinking about Proofreader's Toolkit.
Yeah, and there are lots of different ways that we can actually, you know, think about our technique, if you like. And one sort of classic technique that you'll often hear proofreaders talking about is reading aloud. And the advantage of doing that is that it slows you right down, and it helps you catch awkward phrasing or missing words. So it's avoiding that your brain chunking you know, groups of words and anticipating what is said rather than what is actually there.
And another one is reading backwards. So word by word or sentence by sentence. That's a really fantastic way to focus on the specific spelling and punctuation of a single word rather than meaning.
Yeah.
Though you do not want to be trying that in a novel, but it might be great if you're proofreading greetings cards.
Yeah, I mean, can you imagine doing that on something, some like bruiser of a like 1,000 pages of, you know, Game of Thrones or something like that?
I can't even imagine doing that for a single chapter of a book, never mind. I mean, it's just, it is really for short form content.
It is. I mean, it is better for like, you know, things like, you know, brochures or marketing materials.
Headlines and things like that.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, sometimes the fewer the words, the more important it is to sort of do that sort of thing, isn't
they say that, don't they? I've heard lots of sort of psychologists talk about how the danger, it's a bit like that thing about when you're driving home and you're more likely to have a crash within like, you know, 3 minutes of your house, because that's when you start to relax. And it's a bit like the same when you're you think, oh, that's just a short thing, I've checked that,
you know. Exactly, your eyes just skim over it because you're anticipating what's there. So the other thing just to say alongside that is if you do do that sort of thing, is just don't forget to do a context read as well. So do read it forwards just to make sure it does make sense.
Yeah, yeah.
So another technique, and this is one that I employ all the time in my work, is doing multiple passes. So you could do one pass for content and grammar and another for formatting and style consistency, and you might even break it down even further than that.
Mm. And another might focus on references or image captions. And it, like you say, it just helps to break things up so your mind stays fresh.
Yeah, absolutely. And speaking of your mind staying fresh, do not underestimate the importance of taking breaks, because fresh eyes see things that tired eyes just don't. Yeah, so true, isn't it?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
It seems like such an obvious thing to say, but I don't know an editor, I think, who hasn't made the or been found themselves in a situation where they spent too long without taking a break.
Yeah. Have you ever gone back to something that you worked on for an extended period of time and you looked at it, you think, oh no, I've missed stuff there. I have to go back and do it. I can't trust that I caught everything there because I'm seeing things now, you know.
Yeah.
It's quite depressing. Yeah. Yeah. So another technique tip that I'd add to that is make a separate note in your checklist about recurring errors or tricky points that you think you might overlook or you've spotted and you think might come up at a later point in your in the book. Or
yeah, that's a really good idea.
On. Yeah.
And it also, sometimes there can be, you know, we can all have blind spots as well, can't we? So it can be quite a useful way of just making sure, like, I need to focus on that. But I think the magic really happens when you combine your tools, your checklists and your techniques into a workflow. I mean,
definitely.
That's just...
Yeah, I think unquestionable. It's like it's greater than the sum of its parts, I think, when you when you put all these things together. Yeah. So, for example, you might start with a spell check using software, and then you might use a different piece of software to do a consistency check. And then you might use a checklist to verify style choices and formatting for a project. And then finally, you might do a read for context pass as well.
And that each element supporting the other. And so that's making your proofreading more thorough and consistent, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. And I'd say that over time, many proofreaders develop their own sort of what you might call a signature workflow.
Yeah.
One that they've worked and established that suits their style, their tools, and most importantly, their client types.
Yeah, it's very personal, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
But,
yeah.
You know, because yours might look different to mine, but the point is, I suppose, that it still doesn't matter whether ours are different. They're still grounded in professional best practice.
Yeah, I think that's the really important thing, isn't it? You know, that should be the foundation of everything.
Everything, yeah.
Okay, so why don't we throw out some tips for building your own toolkit?
So start simple. Pick your core tools, a reliable style guide, a software tool, and a basic checklist.
Yeah.
You know, you don't need to have everything. You might not know what you need.
No, I think that's really a key point, is I think sometimes it can be a wee bit overwhelming and you think, oh, I must have this and I must have that and I must have this style guide and that style guide and I must have these macros, even though I don't know what a macro is. You know, all these things. And I think until you get into the swing of things with, you know, particular types of clients, you won't know what you need to invest in, whether that's resources or your own time in understanding maybe certain things like macros, you know. And in terms of techniques, I think it is important that we experiment with different approaches to see what works best for us, depending on the different types of materials that we're working on.
Absolutely. Because you might have something, a particular way of doing things, a particular technique for or approach when you're working, especially if you're a person who works on lots of, you know, I mean, we've got colleagues who are more generalists, say, than you and I are. And they do everything, and so they might have different tools and techniques for those things. So but ultimately you only want to be adding more tools and techniques to your toolkit if they genuinely improve accuracy or efficiency or consistency.
I think the thing to remember,
professional standards and practice that we've talked
about, that's
the
key. Absolutely. And I think the thing to remember is the goal isn't having a massive artillery of fancy gadgets and software and reference books, etc., etc. Yeah. It's the goal is consistent, high quality proofreading every single time you do it.
Every time. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, let's go over some key takeaways then. So start simple with software, perfect it is pretty much an industry standard if you're proofreading Word documents. Mm-hmm. But as you develop your proofreading business, you might introduce various macros and other tools too.
Yeah, and it's the same with Microsoft Word and Adobe Reader. These digital platforms are industry standard and they're reliable and generally stable.
Yeah. Also, keep reference tools handy. So style guides, dictionaries and thesauri, you don't necessarily, you know, need to splash out on expensive resources.
Yeah, that's so true. You know, clients might have their own style guides. Yeah. And many of the big name dictionaries like Merriam-Webster, Oxford and Collins, they've got excellent free online resources that you can use.
And then use checklists to help you keep track of your checking. So it's not just, you know, it's not just about doing good checking. You need to make sure that you've remembered to do all the various checks of the various elements in your text.
Definitely.
Your text.
Yeah. And remember what we said about taking breaks and pacing yourself. Fresh eyes catch more errors. There's no question.
Yeah.
So I think the overall point to remember is that it's when we combine our tools, our checklists and our techniques that we're more likely to deliver consistent and high quality work.
You're building a system, aren't you? Mm, one that's going to give clients confidence in your skills, but give you confidence too in your process.
Absolutely. So, shall we have a wee chat about our different approaches to proofreading? Because as you said earlier, you and I work with different client types and on very different types of text, don't we?
Yeah. So maybe just quickly, the first thing to do is just to, for us each to say what those are, just so people know how we're coming at this.
Okay.
So I work with solely with independent authors who are writing crime fiction, thrillers, mysteries and suspense. That's all I do. Yep. I always work in Word.
And I am so different to that. So I work mainly with big publishers on education materials, particularly English language teaching resources and teaching materials, but also with big organisations, comms agencies, as well as independent authors. So quite a mix, but always non-fiction, no fiction.
Always non-fiction.
Always non-fiction. Like, yeah.
So it'd be interesting to compare the different, well, we can see, like, be interesting to see where it matches in terms of tools.
Where we have a crossover, yes.
Yeah, tools in the media you work in.
Uh-huh.
So why don't you go first?
Yeah. So you said that you always work in Word. Mm-hmm. I do a lot of work in Word for copy editing. So I do a lot of copy editing for publishers, as I said, but also for, you know, organisations, businesses, that sort of thing. And copy editing is always done in Word.
Yeah.
I also do a huge amount of proofreading in PDF form. So my proofreading is almost always in PDF. So I use Acrobat a lot, Adobe Acrobat. And sometimes I do get asked to proofread in Word. But honestly, it's hardly ever a proofread. It's more like a proof edit, really. If it's in Word, it's not laid out. It's not
that traditional idea of proofreading,
like a traditional
isn't it, where you're like checking designed page proofs.
Yeah, exactly.
It's more a quality. I think when we're working in Word, we can think of it more as the sort of like quality control check.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's
yeah.
very much based on the text when it's in Word. It's not necessarily so much. I mean, there will be a little bit of layout stuff, but it's
I also do stuff in for learning materials. I do checking quality assurance in LMSs and learning management systems. So in the back end of digital things, and I also do stuff proofreading on like slide decks, so you know, PowerPoint slides and things like that. And occasionally, Google Docs. Don't love Google Docs.
It's interesting because, I mean, we can talk a little bit about Word in a minute in terms of how both of us use that, which I suspect is quite similar because, you know, Word's Word.
Yeah.
But let's put that to one side for a moment. You mentioned you sometimes work in the back end of LMSs and in Google Docs. And my first thought when you said that was, that means she can't use macros, she can't use Perfectit, she can't use any of those sort of those sort of standard industry standard plugins that a lot of professional editing people who are doing proofreading work count on. So
yeah,
that's interesting.
Yeah, it's I think the thing
it's
about
your eyes.
It's your eyes, yes. Square eyes by the end of it. If you're working in an LMS, there's a lot of, I think the thing about that I find is it's a lot of repetitive work often. So that's where checklists are really important to make sure I haven't missed anything.
Interesting.
And it's not, it tends not to be large blocks of text where you might want to run something like Perfectit or something like that. So you're relying on very much your sort of analog, you know, ways
and I suppose
of checking.
Then the consistency element, because if it is really important, because all those within an LMS, you're going to have certain elements that are performing the same function. So they need to.
Yeah.
So you need that like, physical reminder of you know, what font size is that, or what font is that, or like, where's that linking to, or blah, blah, blah,
all,
blah, blah.
All these bullet lists have to start with a gerund, or all these answers have to be in, you know, this tense or whatever.
Yeah.
And they've all got to be, these have all got to be styled italic, or these have all got to be styled bold. So a checklist of that, and usually a sample to show you what it should look like, is really helpful as a reminder. And to be honest, as you get into it, often you then start to hold that in your head of what it all, it becomes more automatic. But as soon as you move away from that and work on something else, you've forgotten it.
But that's a really good tip you mentioned there. Like if people do find themselves having with work, you know, being approached by clients who want them to work in an LMS, to ask for a sample of what of what it should look like, you know, just in case the client doesn't provide you with that.
Yeah,
that,
because you want to know.
That's a good idea.
Yeah. And also in an LMS, you should be able to usually, if you're working in the back end, you can usually click and see what it looks like front end to make sure that it's you know, it's styled properly and it's, you know, rendering the right way. But it's often that with that you're checking like answers and has, you know, has the correct answer, if it's a multiple choice, has the correct one been selected so that when somebody, if they write a wrong answer, are they getting the right feedback? You know, is it the correct? So it's lots of cross-referencing and that. So a checklist is, you usually get a pretty comprehensive brief for something like that. And that's where I would absolutely use the brief to form my checklist to make sure that I don't miss anything. So LMSs are a bit of a, not an outlier, but it's slightly different to other sort of formats of Word. But Google Docs that you mentioned, most of the time, the clients that I work with who want me to use Google Docs are generally okay with me downloading it and working in Word document and then uploading it back.
Ah, right. Gotcha.
Which makes a big difference. But there are the occasional ones who say, no, just work in Google Docs, which means some of the things are not available to you, like macros. You can't use them. And you also, which I find really annoying in Google Docs, you can't show hidden characters. So you can't click on your little Pilcro and show all your hidden characters.
Yeah.
And I do believe there's an add-in somewhere for that. I think I tried to download it once, but it didn't feel very stable. I didn't like it.
Yeah.
So not ideal. Not ideal. Do you work in Google Docs or do you do the same sort
Never.
Of thing?
No, I mean, I'm not saying I haven't done in the past, but it's so long ago. It's just like, I mean, that's just part of my terms and conditions. I'll only work in Word. And I mean, sometimes clients will, my authors might have worked in something like Scrivener and then, but you know, the agreement
can
is.
Can they convert they will, that okay though?
Yeah.
And
can
they always come export across that fine as and, a doc, yeah, as
yeah,
a docx.
Yeah, like, it, I think, I believe Scrivener gives you the option to actually, you know, download into a Word document. And then, sometimes there's a few little oddities that show up. And we, you know, I've had conversations with clients before and they've said, oh, I reckon that happened because of just the way it's laid out in Scrivener. But nothing that's not
manageable,
eminently sortable. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I suppose my favourite tools within Word are very much, I mean, you've mentioned them already. We mentioned them actually when we were talking. It's Word's onboard features like using find and replace and various Word macros and of course Perfectit. But I actually like, I don't know if you ever use this, but I quite like Word's just as an extra thing. I like its editor function.
Oh, right. I've, yeah.
I've found that sometimes pulls up.
Yeah.
Just little things that I've missed that, you know, I mean, obviously Perfect It is a consistency checker. It's not a spell checker. And sometimes it will find things that I thought I'd caught, but it's just another really easy thing to use. It's right there. And so I find that quite a useful tool.
Yeah, I use it occasionally, but it's not, I wouldn't say it's a core part of my toolkit, but it's something that I might sometimes switch on and think, I'll just run this through just in case. Yeah. And like you say, there's usually always something that it just picks up. It might just be the odd little double word or something like that. Or, you know, something that I would have thought I would have picked up, or, you know, Perfect it would have picked up or whatever. But yeah. Do you work in PDF ever?
No.
No, you don't. So your proofreading's all in Word. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, I'll the thing is about me that I'm very rarely asked to proofread.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I mean, I'll talk about this in a minute when we get onto our techniques section. The only thing I was going to throw in now in terms of preferred tools was that I think because I'm a fiction editor, there's probably some macros that are a much bigger part of my toolkit than might be part of yours. And that's things like things that allow me to very quickly, you know, switch around punctuation that's in the wrong place because it's dialogue, or ones that allow me to do proper noun checks, so name checks, you know, to make sure that I haven't got a Darren Davis and a Darren Davies, you know, things that will highlight issues as part of that consistency.
Yeah.
Whereas I think probably, I mean, you might come across that in some of your ELT stuff as well.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Probably less in the ELT stuff, but more in maybe some of the reports or the academic monographs and things where I'll maybe run something like proper nounalize or something like that, just to pick up, like you say, names and things like that, inconsistencies there. I've got a few little macros that sometimes are job specific where there was one where I had to like copy a certain amount of text and put it into a new document every single time I worked on it. And I just ran a wee macro to immediately copy it, open a new document and paste it into that. And it would just, you know, just make things, repetitive things, quicker. But that's not a typical job that I do. So I don't use a huge number of macros, probably much fewer than you do. But they are incredibly useful. I love to use the navigation pane in Word. Use it a lot my nonfiction books that are, you know, especially things like self-help books, and, you know, you want to just make sure that all your heading hierarchies are correct and that everything follows the same sequence and they're all styled correctly, whether that's, you know, sentence case or title case or whatever. You can see all that in your navigation pane, and it jumps out at you when things aren't consistent. So
I use that in the same way as for, you know, obviously my chapter numbers and again the case of if sometimes an author will only use chapter numbers, sometimes they'll also have chapter titles as well, so again, just seeing the case there, I mean, for me, being able to jump between those things, especially if, you know, I'm actually, this isn't really a proofreading thing, but there are times when I may sort of need to flip back to something or want to move something, and it just helps with that. So
absolutely. Hierarchies, it's really useful.
So let's have a chat about techniques, because again, I think possibly it's interesting because I used to, as you know, I used to work for publishers eons ago and on social science stuff. So, you know, I've been there, but let's forget about that because you can, from my point of view, because you can talk about the some of the techniques you use. Mm. The one thing I would say, if anybody's listening who's a fiction editor doing a proofread, even when I'm line editing. So if you're a line editor for an indie author, you won't be able to guarantee that your author will necessarily have the budget to go ahead and organise invest in a proofread. Mm. You know, often indie authors make decisions about where they're going to focus, you know, where their biggest problems are. So maybe they'll invest in structural editing, but then do it themselves for the other things. And so one thing that I do is that even though I haven't been commissioned to proofread, when I'm line editing, when I come to the end of a chapter, I stop. I've done my line edits. I've done my stylistic interventions and suggestions and la, 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 la. I go back and I read through, usually out loud, the whole chapter. And that's actually something I've only been doing for about the past year.
Interesting.
And because I realised that because a lot of the authors I'm working with are sometimes quite new, it might be their first novel. Mm-hmm. And so I've made quite a lot of suggested changes. And as you know, Denise, you know, the more you interfere, the more likely it is that you introduce errors as well as fix them.
Absolutely.
And so, and I was finding that I was, you know, doing lots of, you know, really, really powerful stylistic interventions, but I was finding that I was also introducing a few problems. So what I now do is go through and I go back and I proofread, and I'm not focusing on style here. I'm not focusing on, you know, anything to do with the sort of like, you know, the tension or the drama or the suspense or the, you know, it's not prose work in that sense at all. It's just like, does everything make sense here? It's quality control. And it doesn't take me that much longer. And yet I always find things. And it just means that when I get to the end of my line edit, I'm confident, not that it's perfect, because nobody can achieve that stage anyway.
No. Yeah.
But I'm hoping that I want to be in a position where I'm giving it back in the best possible shape from a quality control perspective that I can, even though I wasn't commissioned to proofread.
That's so, one of those sort of added value things that we were talking about in one of our other episodes, isn't it? It's like you weren't strictly asked to do that, but you're giving your client the most rounded edit that you can within their budget.
And it makes me feel more confident about the quality of work I'm presenting. So it's a little plus proofread to add on. But I do it on a chapter-by-chapter basis. I think the idea of going back after I've line edited an entire novel and thinking, oh, right, now I'll proofread that. That's, to me, that would be a second pass. That's different. Yeah.
Yes.
Whereas I am prepared to do an overview of each chapter, and it just, it helps me consolidate my line work as well. So, so that's just a technique that I've sort of really sort of made a part, a sort of formal part of my practice. I'm not saying I never did it before, but it's become a standard part of my practice now.
And it's interesting, I think, that given how long you've been doing this, that that's something that you've only just fairly recently come to recognise as being a valuable thing that you can introduce into your practice.
Yeah.
And I think that really demonstrates really nicely that we can all still learn and refine
ways
how
of doing
we work.
Things.
And absolutely. Yeah. I think that's a really sort of powerful message, really. Yeah.
So do you have any specific techniques that you prefer with the type of work you do?
So I think one of the things I do, so I get quite a lot of repeat work from publishers to work on either different types of materials within the same ecosystem of a course, maybe, you know, student book, teacher's book, workbook, readers, resources, you know, all, lesson plans, all those sort of things. Or maybe newer editions of other books that I've worked on a couple, because they can update educational stuff quite quickly, actually. So I might be asked to work on a newer edition of something that I maybe worked a couple of years before. And what I find really helpful is I go back and lift out the style sheet that I had for that job and save it, give it a new name, but I keep a lot of the content there, a lot of the content that will still be relevant from that, because it's pertaining specifically not just to the overall house style from that publisher, but to that specific
specific book.
So that I'm being consistent. And I'm not starting from scratch, trying to remember or to look back at a brief. I'm working from a live document that was created for another book in that series that I worked on. So that saves me a lot of time because I feel that it gives me a running start.
Do you know what? That's actually relevant to fiction proofreaders, though, as well, because...
Sure. If you're working on series.
If you're working a series, yeah. Especially when it comes to, you know, just making sure that straightforward stylistic choices you made about, like, that fits across the book, but also, of course, character names. You know, like, if you're proofreading character names, everything might be consistent. In a book, but it actually doesn't match the the way the author had handled them in the previous one. That is a good specific technique, I think, across the board.
So you know, not starting from scratch every single time. Don't get rid of that sort of stuff. Hold on to it because you never know when you're going to use it again.
And an author might come back to you.
Oh yeah.
Several years later.
Oh yeah.
So you should, you know, it's best not to assume that, like, oh, we haven't heard from them in a year, therefore, you know.
No. It can be years, and you get a call back for something. So yeah, by all means archive it, but don't delete it.
Go on. No, I was gonna ask if you have a specific technique when you're you know, you were talking about how you sometimes do different passes for different elements. So I don't know. I mean, we could probably do an entire episode just about this because of the kind of work you do. But for example, with references or in text citations, do you have a specific technique or a specific point in the process where you or a contents list? Is there a specific techniques where you will proofread those things in a certain way or at a certain point in the project?
Yeah. So I almost always, I always print off the contents page, and also if it's a student's book or a teacher's book and it's got a scope and sequence at the front of it, I'll print that off as well. Because I'll be referring back to them constantly going through it. So obviously it helps as a first headline pass of your chapters and things to make sure, or your units, if we're talking about education, your unit titles to make sure that they all match up and that your page numbers are all the same. But I just also use it as a reference point for how things are styled, because very often in educational books like these, different units have different colours, so and different things are colour coded and styled differently. So it's making sure that that's consistent across the board. So having the contents page and the scope and sequence with those sorts of style elements and formatting elements in them helps me as a quick reference point when I'm actually working through. And I will do absolutely multiple passes looking at specific things, like your unit titles, your rubrics, all your grammar boxes, all your audio scripts, all those sort of things. Every different element, I'll do a separate pass for it. It feels very counterintuitive when you
first. But that's the key thing about proofreading complex materials with all those multiple elements. I mean, you have to treat them.
Yeah, you have to look at them individually.
And in different ways, how they're relating to different things. So,
you can't possibly hold in your head how all of these different elements look in a double page spread and check everything in one go on each double page spread or in each unit, something that might only appear once in a unit. You need to check them all at the same time because you'll forget how that's styled, and you're going to have to flip back and forward anyway. So you might as well do it in a cohesive way. So that's something that you might call a pass, or you might call it a horizontal check, where you're checking the same thing across the board, maybe in multiple documents. Maybe I'm thinking maybe like a lesson plan that's very heavily templated, and checking the same element in all of these different documents in one go, and then next element in all of these different lesson plans in one go. So
a horizontal
check. Yeah. It's very efficient. It's very efficient. And that's why with those sort of materials, it's almost impossible to send it back in bits. If somebody gives you an entire book to work on in one go, you have to do the whole thing before you hand any of it back. Quite often I get units sent to me unit by unit, but I've got such a structured brief and structured checklist that I can do that per unit because I know exactly what's to be in each unit, how it's styled. Does that
make sense? It's interesting you mentioned that there, though, that idea of that it's impossible to send bits back in, you know, sort of piecemeal, because obviously that's exactly the same for me. I wouldn't ever dream of working, you know, on chapter by chapter and sending someone something back as I go, because I think that would be a catastrophe. You know, I think 20 years ago it would have crossed my mind because I was working on different types of material then.
That's but the thing,
now
isn't it?
It's kind of, you know, it was an interesting reminder that that does, that is the way some people are required to work.
Yeah. And to be fair, I do. It's not that it can't be done. It depends on how the material is formatted and presented to you in the first place. So I'm working on two different projects at the moment, which I'm doing both of them in batches. And it's fine because the format is the same in all of them.
Yeah.
So I can easily check a unit or a file or, you know, a chapter in a book, and it's very specifically styled and formatted. And I know that if I check it in that, it's not going to have any knock-on effects for anything else because it's all set, you know, it's all already organized. I'm just checking that it's all been applied properly and it all makes sense. So in that sort of situation, you can do things in batches. So, you know, one file per chapter or one file per unit or whatever.
Yeah.
It does depend on the material. But certainly if somebody sent me a book to, you know, like a business book or something or an academic monograph and said, oh, if you finish the first few chapters, can I have them back? The answer would be no, because that's not how it works. We don't work linearly, do we, when we're working through that sort of material?
Here's a question. We probably should have dealt with it when we started talking about tools, but I think it might be useful for, particularly for new proofreaders, just to, you know, throw out quickly what our favorite dictionary is. What's our favorite software tool, favorite dictionary, favorite style guide? I mean, maybe for you it won't be favorite. It might be most used, but
yeah.
I'm gonna go for favorites because
you get to choose those sort of things. So, what are your favorites? You tell me.
So, favorite software. Piece of software has to be Perfectit. I think it's an excellent consistency checker. It is not the only tool in my toolbox. It can't be. But in terms of what it is, what my expectations of it are, I think it does them extraordinarily well.
Yeah.
My favourite, I'm going to have two dictionaries. I'm going to pick Merriam-Webster when I'm working for clients based in the States. Most of my clients are either from the US or they're in the UK. Not all, but usually. And so I love Merriam-Webster for that. But also I subscribe to Oxford Dictionaries Online via my library. So it's free. So
yeah,
I love that. And then my favourite style guide has to be the Chicago Manual of Style, because for proofreading, it has such good advice. I mean, it's certainly not, you wouldn't think of the Chicago Manual of Style as being a fiction editor's go-to if until you are a fiction editor and you start using it, because actually its guidance is so sensible. It's so respectful of different Englishes, of different preferences, of the changing nature of language. And I just find it as a really good starting guide that I can choose to ignore when I need to. But it's just got some really, it's even got good advice for helping me work out if I'm going to ignore it. You know,
absolutely.
It explains why it suggests this. And then I might think, right, well, that's the reason that I'm not going to actually apply it on this occasion. But, you know, at least it's an informed decision. So those are mine.
Good. And do you have your CMOS linked through your Perfectit so you can
although I also I often find myself using it just, I have an online subscription,
just use it independent of Perfectit as well,
because CMOS in Perfectit it is not as comprehensive as
right
as
okay
the full whack of scenes. Yeah. You know, it's good, but you know, it's a bit like when you buy a mini dictionary and then you get a big copy of Chambers or something and you go, whoa, this has got loads more words in it. So I have an online sub to Chicago because I like to see, I like all the other nuggets in there just of that wouldn't necessarily.
It's a real rabbit hole once you go down.
Yeah, to be to do with consistency choices. They might it might have advice on spelling or
sure.
Or, I don't know. Just other things. Yeah. What about you?
My favourite software. Sorry to be a copycat, but it is Perfecto because for all the reasons you've said, it just makes my job so much easier and never fails to help me out when I'm running stuff through that. I couldn't imagine not having it, honestly.
But we both have experienced editorial life without it.
I know.
Which is weird.
Gives me the fear, actually, thinking, what did I miss? <You know>? What I thought. Yeah, so perfect it. Game changer. So absolutely. What was the other thing? Dictionary.
So I mentioned dictionaries and style guides, and it might be that might be trickier for you, the style guides one anyway, but
I say dictionary. I also have a subscription to the Oxford Premium online, so that gives you access to like your all sorts of thesauruses,
new hearts rules, all that stuff. And stuff like that.
I don't have mine through my library. I actually haven't even investigated to see if it's available through my library.
Well, you should do, because it's free,
but do you know how much it costs for an annual subscription?
Oh, it's something. It isn't much, is it?
It's £16.66, which is the best.
I know, but you could buy two coffees with that.
I could maybe even buy three, because I don't even drink coffee. Also online, I really like the Collins online dictionary, and I work on quite a lot of Collins material, so it makes sense for me.
So that's a good fit.
Yes, but if I'm working on US stuff, then also Merriam-Webster.
Yeah.
I'm working on a US English book at the moment as well. Got a lot of different projects going on just now. Merriam-Webster is the go-to for that.
Yeah.
So that's that. Style guides.
Can I just pop in one thing? One of the things I really like about, I'm sure other big name dictionaries do this as well, but one of the things I really appreciate about Merriam-Webster and Oxford is that they show you where there are alternative spellings, usually in the US, they will give you an indication if there's a different preference or that a preference is going to bend one way, that it's more likely in a certain country.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that's the case for, something like Chambers or Macmillan or Collins
possibly,
or something like that.
Yeah. Macmillan's online dictionary is no more, I think. I think that was stopped a few years ago.
Gone?
I think it's gone, yeah. Style guide, you say New Hearts rules, but I like the New Oxford Style Manual, which includes New Hearts rules, and I think it's the New Oxford Dictionary for Writers
and
Editors.
I've still got a hard copy of those.
So have I. The old editions of them.
Yeah. But and they were really handy the other day because I couldn't get into, I lost my library card number and I couldn't, and Oxford changed their portal. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't get in because my computer used to remember the number before and it didn't remember it anymore. So I was without a library card. I couldn't get in. So I had to actually get a book out and look up how to do something. But it was quite nice.
Very old school, isn't it? Yeah. But I find for each job that I do, there's always a website that I usually have to refer to all the time with, particularly because I'm maybe working on nonfiction books that I'm, it might have been the Isle of Man TT database, or I'm working on a book on the Le Mans 24-hour endurance race at the moment. So I've got their database open with all their winners and times and number of laps.
Because
I'm cross-checking all that to make sure that it's accurate and the order of all the, drivers and everything. So there's always usually with every sort of project you work on, there's always a website that you've got open all the time just to double check all these sort of facts as well. So your search tool is just like, if anyone had a look at it, you're thinking, oh my god, what is this woman looking at these days?
One thing I'm going to shove in then, as a fiction, from a fiction proofreader's perspective, is the Urban Dictionary, because that's that's superb for if you're just wondering how to hyphenate a, or you come across a sweary or a piece of slang that you, is just, you know, you realise I'm the wrong generation for this. But I want to sort of, you know, at least choose a, especially if your author spelt it in two different ways because they've used it a couple of times. And then you go, yep, check that.
Is it just one word? Is it hyphenated? Is it two words?
Well, what's funny is actually when you realise it was in Oxford or Merriam-Webster all along,
all the time,
you realise
yeah.
that's when you realise you are of the wrong generation because it's actually come into
standard usage.
So should we talk about the order of play? Because sometimes it's quite fun to, you know, it's quite interesting how, from a proofreading perspective, you can end up discovering that for you personally, there are things that you like to do at certain points in the project. Have you got any of those?
If I need to sort of get copy editing out of my head, if I'm thinking about proofreading, I like to start, like I said, with the table of contents and the scope and sequence and look at the bigger picture. I start with that. So making sure all the colours are right, all the unit headings are right, they're all styled properly. So I sort of describe it like peeling an onion. I start from the outside and I just peel the, a bit like Shrek and Donkey when they talked about
Donkey.
You know, peeling an onion and all these layers is like, you know, I start from the outside and work in, looking at all these different elements. I don't think it matters within that, the order of the more similar interior elements, like, you know, things like lists or grammar boxes or things, as long as they all get done, it doesn't matter. But I always like to get the sort of hierarchies out the way first and make sure that that's all there and consistent. And obviously it's dictated by what the brief is as well, because sometimes they'll say to you, don't check X, Y, or Z. It's already been done, or someone else is going to do that when they do another part of whatever, or something isn't available yet. I mean, if there's a lot of images or tables or things, you know, there'll be a pass to check all of them to make sure they're all captioned and numbered, all that. So I don't know that I necessarily do them all in the same order every single time, but the key thing is those bigger ones first, those sort of higher hierarchy things, and then whatever comes up in my checklist, I just work my way through all that. And sometimes as you go, you find it makes sense, or if I'm checking this, it makes sense to check this at the same time, you know, and you might join a couple of things together. What about you?
Yeah, it's quite personal, isn't it? I mean, it's sort of similar in a way, in that I think your onion peeling donkey is applies to me with in the way I treat chapter numbers. The first thing I often do when I'm and this applies actually to whatever level of editing I'm doing, I check that all the chapter numbers are chronological, and it's just one of those things that helps me start to see the layout of the book. But I will always, because it's such an easy thing to do, particularly because I'm working in Word and I can use the navigation pane, I will always recheck at the end those chapter numbers and chapter titles again and just proofread them to make sure that my eyes haven't gone bonkers and I haven't, you know, got two chapter 13s and all the case sensitivity isn't inconsistent. It's just something I like to do twice. The first time is just to sort of get me into the groove, that I suppose the end check is sort of you know, it's closure point and just a confidence check. Then in between, if I'm proofreading, I start at the beginning and I finish at the end. I don't have anything clever, or, you know, I'm reading a story. So.
Yeah, exactly. So you have to be linear for that, really.
I do want to be linear about those things. And I think in terms of proofreading checks that I can do via software, I'll use Perfectit three times, probably once at the beginning, once in the middle, once at the end. And it's really just for efficiency, because I think if I've set a style, then it's less, it's fewer clicks. It's easier to make those changes as I go on. Mm-hmm. So obviously that's going to change things in a non-linear way. But in terms of the eyeballing work,
I think the other thing to say about using words to be able to use Perfecta is that if you've sometimes presented with a text in PDF, and it maybe is, like, if it's fiction and it is a narrative, is exporting that into Word and then running Perfecta on it there. So you've got the benefits of Perfecta when you're working with a PDF. Now, that doesn't work for the sort of stuff that I'm doing, but if you're working with an indie author, for whatever, not you personally, but if one is working with an indie author and it's already typeset and they want you to proofread it and it's maybe not had a huge amount of editing intervention, I think that can be quite a useful way to
absolutely, because it just pulls out those, you know, maybe there's 20 things that have slipped through the net and you can find them and then you can annotate them on the PDF manually.
Exactly.
I used to do that back in the day when I worked on, when I proofread PDFs, sometimes because I wasn't, again, I tended to be dealing with things with quite a, they weren't complex materials. They were still, so they still had a sort of, you know, single narrative flow going through them. And so, so it was text. And so I could absolutely use that to give me a body of stuff that I could do things like run macros in or do text analysis. You know, to find out certain things, and then the changes would actually be made manually on the PDF.
Yeah.
But having that option to export into Word just it just allowed you to do a different, you know, do a different element
check,
of the proofreading in a different format.
Definitely. So that's it from us. So we really hope you enjoyed this episode and our wee chat at the end of it. Thank you so much for listening to us again. And if you'd like to help support the Editing Podcast, you can join our Patreon community or you can bung us a wee tip.
We'd love to have you on board. And all of our patrons get exclusive access to a huge batch of transcripts. And we'll pop a link in the show notes for you for that. So she's been Denise.
And she's been Louise. Join us again soon. Bye.
Bye.